I had the pleasure of talking with Paul a little bit about his work on John Donne over the last few years. And I suppose my greatest appreciation of Donne is his great sermon on virginity that he preached to the Queen back in those halcyon days. And I'm delighted that he's going to be talking with us today about an aspect of Donne that I know nothing about, and I'm looking forward to hearing about. But it's great to have you. You all know Paul is one of the wonderful and distinguished professors here at Augustana, and a very fine colleague. So, thank you.
Thank you, David. So, it's a pleasure to do this. It's always great for me to talk about Donne. I've been working on Donne for a long time and keep coming back to him. And so what I want to present today is just some things that have been drawn over a number of areas I've been working in over the last many years. And it seemed like it was a fitting sort of topic for the Chester Ronning Center, because it seeks to look at that intersection between religion and public life. So, to get things off, I just want to rehearse for you what I put out as the information about this talk. So let's just go through that a bit. So, these are some of the issues I want to raise. How does a public intellectual close to the powerful and influential persuade those authorities to moral and responsible action? Case of John Donne, one of the greatest poets and preachers of the 17th century, offers a fascinating illustration of precisely this problem. Operating under the conditions of strict censorship, Donne had to find a way of convincing monarch, courtiers, and churchmen alike that certain courses of action would tear their country apart. Yet, how could Donne find his voice without losing his head? Furthermore, how could he advise in a way that might turn powerful interests away from paths that were personally and socially destructive and invite them towards better solutions? Donne addresses court corruption in his poetry. He warns against royal absolutism in his role as royal chaplain. And he attempts to persuade against brutality in England's colonial adventures. Analyzing Donne's words and actions will help us to understand his methods in difficult and dangerous circumstances. Naturally, we will also want to ask what sort of contemporary relevance Donne's methods might have for us in the present day. So, first of all, I just want to start with a kind of background. Some of you are probably familiar with Donne. Others are probably not familiar with Donne. So, there's a picture, and we probably need a little lights. That takes that moment to see those eyes. There we go.
That's it?
Yeah, I think that worked out well. There are many portraits of Donne. This is probably maybe one of the most famous of the portraits. He is presented here in a melancholy pose. The crossed arms, the pensive face, the big hat are all iconic emblems of the melancholic. So pensive, sad, ruminating. It was a typical pose for a melancholy lover. And so that's the pose that he is presenting himself in here. So this is Donne as a fairly young man. And another thing maybe you want to notice is Donne's dates, 1572 to 1631. Just to sort of situate you in English history, therefore, Donne's early life is under the reign of Elizabeth, then under the reign of King James I and VI, and then the reign of Charles I. Charles I, of course, you'll know, was the only English king to be beheaded and was involved in the English Civil Wars. So we see the kind of turbulent period that Dunn lived in, and it is in that context that he tries to respond. Anyway, a little background on Dunn. So Dunn was born into a famous Catholic family. And of course, in England at this time, it was a very difficult thing to be a Catholic. You were almost immediately suspected of being a subversive. It was possible to prosper as a Catholic in England, but it was somewhat difficult, and it could be dangerous. For instance, it was a treasonable offense for any Jesuit or seminary priest to be found within the monarch's realm. One of John Dunn's two Jesuit uncles, he had two Jesuit uncles, one of them, Jasper Hayward, whom he had visited in the Tower, was tracked down, tried, and sentenced to be hanged, drawn, and quartered. So many critics have speculated that Dunn's relationship to his family's traditional religion was formative and difficult. I'll just provide you with a little graphic illustration here. This is the typical punishment for traitors. And so you would be hanged while still alive. You would be disemboweled, and then you would be cut in force. So you can see why. And of course, on London Bridge, I have a slide of this presently. On London Bridge, of course, would be the heads of traitors. So before you entered the monarch's capital city, you would be warned what happens to traitors. And so it relates very, very seriously to this whole question of censorship that we're going to talk about in a moment. So Dunn did convert to the state religion, Anglicanism, the Church of England, and we're unsure when this actually took place, but judging from the painstaking intellectual argumentation that usually marks Dunn's writings, we can assume that it was a carefully thought-out position. It probably took place sometime in the 1590s. Dunn studied at both English universities, at Cambridge and Oxford. He also studied at Lincoln's Inn, which is where lawyers in London were trained. He also would have been influenced by many of the alienated young intellectual men that were hanging about at the end of the reign of Elizabeth. It was a time when all the choice court appointments had been given out, and so there was a kind of backlog of young intellectuals wanting court appointment, but there was nothing much for them there at the end of the reign of Elizabeth. So with the accession of James, there was hope for a lot of those plum appointments. Anyway, Dunn read voraciously on all subjects, and in a letter he admitted to having an hydroptic, immoderate desire of humane learning and languages. Among his many talents, Dunn was renowned as a poet whose poetry circulated in manuscript. His poetry was witty, dense, it was intellectual, and it was noted for its extravagant comparisons, unlikely comparisons that are, as Dr. Johnson said, yoked as by violence together. Anyway, this is very different from the poetry of the Hearts and Flowers school that was so prevalent in the period. However, as a Renaissance man, a typical Renaissance man, Dunn would not make a vocation out of poetry. It was simply one of many talents expected of clever young men looking for advancement. In a letter, Dunn wrote, "The Spanish proverb informs me that he is a fool that cannot make one sonnet, and he is mad, which makes two." You see what he's getting at? Of course, Dunn wrote more than two sonnets. But what he's getting at is the notion that, of course, you need to know how to write poetry. Can't everybody? But, you know, to spend your life doing it would not be a wise or a sensible course of action. Anyway, as a Renaissance man, he did see combat. He went to Spanish Cadiz and the Azores with Raleigh and Essex. He was a private secretary to Sir Thomas Egerton, who was the Lord Keeper. And while he was employed there in 1601, he married Sir Thomas's niece, who was well above Dunn's social station. I think Dunn's plan was that forgiveness is an easier path than asking permission. However, forgiveness was not given. When Anne Moore's father found out about the marriage, he had Dunn fired and thrown in jail. Upon investigation, it turned out that the marriage was perfectly legal, and so nothing could be done. Anne was, nonetheless, disinherited, and so Dunn made up a little rhyme about the occasion. John Dunn, Anne Dunn, undone. So John and Anne appeared to be a very loving couple, but they led a fairly difficult life. They were poor, and Anne had 12 children in 14 years, not including miscarriages, and she died when she was 33. Well, when Dunn was about 40, he was hired by Thomas Morton, Dean of Gloucester, to consider religious questions. He wrote some tracts against the excesses of Roman Catholicism. After deferring for many years, King James made it clear that he would prefer him, but only in terms of the church, not in terms of court positions. And so the debate continues as to whether Dunn was holding out for court advancement or whether he was seriously questioning whether he was worthy to be a minister in the Church of England. However, in 1615, Dunn took holy orders. He became a reader in divinity at Lincoln's Inn, where he had been a student. He later was made Dean of St. Paul's Cathedral in London, and he is best renowned for being a captivating preacher, one of the best in his or any other time. So let me just show you. This is London in Dunn's time. Here's London Bridge, and of course the detail is probably too fine for you to notice, but there are those heads on stakes as you go across the bridge into London proper. You'll notice that this is St. Paul's Cathedral. Of course, it's different from the St. Paul's Cathedral in London now. This church burned in 1666 with the Great Fire of London. But that's where Dunn was dean. Here's a detail of St. Paul's Cathedral. And you do get the sense of London as being not that big a town. I mean, it was big by European standards, but it was certainly a manageable city. Then just this last picture as well. This is St. Paul's Cathedral, and this is Paul's Cross, which was an outdoor pulpit. Dunn did preach there on occasion, as did other important preachers, but it does give you a sense of what it looked and felt like in that period. Anyway, Dunn died in 1631 after he preached a sermon on death and resurrection, and people at the time commented that it was Dunn's own funeral sermon. So anyway, that's just a little bit to set the frame, the historical frame for Dunn and what he was about. What I want to do now is to move on and talk a little bit about the conditions of censorship in England at the time. So I've already referred to the fact that Dunn's own uncle was hanged, drawn, and quartered for his religion. It's important to remember, of course, that these were tough times in terms of religion. Elizabeth expected her country to be invaded by Spain, and with it, of course, would come the horrors of the Inquisition. Under the reign of Elizabeth, there was a constant fear that Catholic subversive agents were attempting to murder and overthrow the Protestant monarch. But this was not paranoia on the Queen's part either. It was real fear. Consequently, Catholic priests were outlawed in England by 1585. In the meantime, Pope Gregory XIII had excommunicated the Queen, had issued orders that her subjects need not obey her, and the Pope also announced that the murder of the Queen would not be a mortal sin. So you can see the tension in the realm at that period. So the sitting monarch, any one of her subjects, is told by the Pope that she can be murdered without eternal consequence. So it's a pretty testy time and a turbulent religious time. I just wanted to show you this is a cartoon from the period showing, you know, here's Calvin, here's Luther, here's the Pope, and they're all fighting amongst themselves. So, you know, the Reformation is underway. The English Reformation, a little bit later, is underway, and of course, Catholicism is fighting for ground against these upstart religions. And then just these two actors, Pope Gregory XIII and Elizabeth. Oh, I can't. You know, whenever I see these things, just to give you a sense of the period. Of course, you know, this is a very iconic picture. There's Elizabeth with all the glory of her office and the wealth and prestige of the office. She has her hand on the globe. There's the crown showing her power. In the background, you'll notice the fair weather here and the dark weather here. Of course, this was celebrating the destruction of the Spanish Armada, which did happen with some English skill, but also, and more importantly, took place as a result of a great storm. It was seen as an act of providence and a sign that England was a second Israel, protected by God. And so, you know, that was the kind of propaganda that was put out at the time. Okay, so as I mentioned, these are testy times in religious matters. One anecdote, though, I think will give you a strong sense of the conditions of censorship in religious matters. A professor of religion with, as you will see, the unfortunate name of John Stubbs, had issued a pamphlet in 1579 in which he expressed the apprehensions of the Queen's Protestant subjects that she was planning to marry the Catholic Duke of Anjou. The Queen took great offense in the meddling. The professor and the disperser of the pamphlet were apprehended and tried and convicted. The printer was pardoned, but not so the other two. Here is William Camden's recollection of the event. Not long after, upon a stage set up in the marketplace at Westminster, Stubbs and Page had their right hands cut off by a blow of a butcher's knife with a mallet struck through their wrists. The printer had his pardon. I can remember that standing by John Stubbs, so soon as his right hand was cut off, he put off his hat with the left and cried, "God save the Queen." People round him stood mute, whether stricken with fear at the first sight of this strange kind of punishment, or for commiseration of the man whom they reputed honest, or out of a secret inward repining that had they had at this marriage, which they suspected could be dangerous to religion. So, quite a remarkable moment in that anecdote. You know, what we've got there is, you know, this man accused of meddling has his hand cut off, and yet at the same time, with the other hand, you know, doffs his hat and says, "God save the Queen." So to me, it's a marvelous illustration of the power of the monarch to exert his or her marks upon the whole realm. This is the sign of power. The ultimate sign of power is the mark that the monarch can place upon the subject. So anyway, these kinds of events would surely exert pressure on the monarch's subjects. Certainly Dunn's memory of his uncle and his famous ancestor Thomas More, beheaded under Henry VIII's reign, would provide internal cautions, that kind of internalized censorship. The monarch's way of inscribing power and demonstrating the extent of his or her authority was by making just such marks on the subjects of the realm. In Dunn's own life, we have evidence of his own anxiety of the king's disapproval. Dunn was commanded to send a copy of one of his sermons to the king, and the bishops of Bath and Wells, because he seemed to appear to favor the more Protestant of the factions in the Church of England. He wrote to Sir Robert Carr of his anxiety and appeared at his door early the next morning after the royal command, seeking intercession. He admits in a letter, "Freely I say to you, I would I were a little more guilty, only mine innocency makes me afraid." Here it seems as though what Dunn's concern is that because he was so scrupulous in writing the sermon on a controversial issue, he feels that someone is using the occasion of the sermon to take him down. Some enemy is doing that. So naturally he is worried about what the king will think. So you can see what Dunn is working with. You know, on the one hand, we have the strong sense of the forces at work to suppress effective advice to the powerful. Now, there is the other side of the question as well. There was also a strong humanist tradition that the courtier's ultimate mission was to advise the prince effectively. Certainly, Erasmus's Education of the Christian Prince asserted the best ways to train up a prince in moral principles. But consider these words from the character Octaviano in Balthazar Castiglione's The Book of the Courtier. And I'm just going to give you a picture of Castiglione. This is what a character in the Book of the Courtier says. "As well as being quick-witted and charming, prudent and scholarly and so forth, he will always have the skill to make his prince realize the honor and advantages that accrue to him and his family from justice, liberality, magnanimity, gentleness, and all the other virtues befitting a ruler. And on the other hand, the infamy and loss that result from practicing the vices opposed to these virtues. Therefore, I consider that just as music, festivities, games, and other agreeable accomplishments are, so to speak, the flower of courtiership, so its real fruit is to encourage and help his prince to be virtuous and to deter him from evil." So, you know, this is an amazing book talking about all the skills that a courtier has to have. But there's the nugget at the center: advising in goodness and attempting to sway the prince from doing evil. Now, Castiglione's book also makes it clear that the courtier should act with sprezzatura, which he defines in this way: to steer away from affectation at all costs, as if it were a rough or dangerous reef, and, to use perhaps a novel word for it, to practice in all things a certain nonchalance which conceals all artistry and makes whatever one says or does seem uncontrived and effortless. To use the Latin proverb, it is art to conceal art. So, you know, I mean, that was the thing about a courtier. A courtier would prepare, whether it's in sword fighting or horsemanship or reciting poetry, would prepare and prepare, and then it would look like, oh, I just thought it up. Just happened on it. I'm able to, you know, leap and bound and sword fight, and I'm able to recite poetry as though it's no problem at all. So, you know, that was on the other side. On the one hand, there is this stricture of censorship. On the other hand, there is this strong humanist tradition saying you must act and act morally. You must advise your prince in the correct way. So the real challenge for the advisor of princes was in the methodology. Asserting moral maxims rarely produces any real results. The trick was in persuading in such a way that what was understood as the word of God was actually incarnated into action. And this idea is central to Dunn's literary technique in both his poetry and his sermons. For Dunn, the state of death occurred when the body and soul were separated, divorced from one another. Soul here, body there, that's what it means to be dead. So either in this world or the next, the reunification of these things must take place to be alive, to be living. So the incarnation of the Word into flesh took place not only in the birth, life, and death of Jesus, but potentially in every human being. So here's what Dunn has to say about this resurrection of the body and the soul. It's a long passage, but it's important. This is what he has to say. Now, the resurrection from this first fall into a divorce is, seriously and wisely, that is, piously and civilly, to consider that man is not a soul alone, but a body too. That man is not placed in this world only for speculation. He is not sent into this world to live out of it, but to live in it. Adam was not put into paradise, only in that paradise to contemplate the future paradise, but to dress and keep the present. God did not breathe a soul towards him, but into him. Not in an obsession, but a possession. Not to travail for knowledge abroad, but to direct him by counsel at home. Not for ecstasies, but for an inherence. But as long as we are in our dwelling upon earth, though we must love God with all our soul, yet it is not with our soul alone. Our body must also testify and express our love, not to run away from the service of God by hiding ourselves in a superstitious monastery, or in a secular monastery, in our own house by an unprofitable retiredness, and absenting ourselves from the necessary businesses of this world, not to avoid a calling by taking none, not to make void a calling by neglecting the due offices thereof. In a word, to understand and to perform in the best measure we can the duties of the body and of the soul. This is the resurrection from the first fall, the fall into a divorce of body and soul. So in a passage like that, I think you can see one of Dunn's very central concerns. What is important for him is to incarnate the Word. And of course, one of the best ways that that takes place is not as it does in the Catholic Mass, which is through the Eucharist, but through the expounding of the Word of God. And the expounding of the Word of God then enters the hearer and is incarnated into action. So it's a reincarnation, as far as Dunn was concerned. Now, My point in quoting this passage is to emphasize the importance of this truth being embodied, turned into action. Indeed, Dunn could be very direct in his views about this embodiment, this imitation of Christ. In one poem, Dunn enjoins, "And be his image, or not his, but he." See the difference? He says, everyone says you should be the image of God. But he says, but I'll go a little further. Not his image. Be he. In other words, become Christ. So it's a very profound sense of what it is you're here to do. You are to imitate Christ in such a way that people actually recognize him. So let's go on to talk about some of the ways in which Dunn engages the court. So Dunn was a popular poet whose poems circulated in manuscript among the young intellectuals of the day. Dunn's poems were part of the imaginative materials of men who would be part of the ruling elite. As a royal chaplain to both King James and later to King Charles, as well as Dean of St. Paul's, Dunn was constantly advising the powerful in his sermons. I'd like to suggest three ways that Dunn thought were useful in bringing about personal transformation. One is to arrest, another is to remind, and another is to provide human examples. These ideas come from his sermons, which are wonderful documents that themselves take a person through a process of transformation, restoring the broken soul to wholeness. Okay, so this first method we can see Dunn using is what he would call nearness. In literature, we would probably call it verisimilitude, that lifelike quality that allows us to recognize ourselves. Here's what Dunn has to say about it. It is not the depth, nor the wit, nor the eloquence of the preacher that pierces us, but his nearness. that he speaks to my conscience as though he had been behind the hangings when I sinned, as though he had read the book of the Day of Judgment already. That's quite an image, isn't it? There you see the preacher hiding behind the arras or the hangings in the room, as though he saw, as though he could discern. So, you know, to me, this is very reminiscent of what you see in Hamlet. You know, Hamlet wants the players in the Mousetrap play to reproduce the crime of the murder of Hamlet's father on stage. And he, of course, says, the play's the thing wherein I'll catch the conscience of the king. That nearness, that closeness, that recognition, that lifelike quality is what causes people to see themselves and to respond. Of course, Dunn's talking about sin. You've been caught in your sin. You must recognize your sin before you can get out of it. So, you know, as far as Dunn is concerned, one of the methods of bringing people to virtuous action is by recognition, this recognizing that takes place in a poem or in a sermon. Another method, the second method that Dunn uses is memory. Dunn saw using the memory, as opposed to using logic, for instance, as a very safe method of recognizing one's wholeness, one's salvation. Whereas one can take the wrong step in following a logical argument, to remember is an act that helps shape one's spiritual character and moral action. As Dunn puts it, the art of salvation is but the art of memory. Every person, no matter what his or her religious training, has experienced an insight into the creative acts of God, because each person has a personal history that parallels the Christian history of salvation. Here's what he has to say about that. He that hears no sermons, he that reads no scriptures, hath a Bible without book. He hath a Genesis in his memory, he cannot forget his creation. He hath an Exodus in his memory, he cannot forget that God hath delivered him from some kind of Egypt, from some oppression. He hath a Leviticus in his memory, he cannot forget that God hath proposed to him some law, some rules to be observed. He hath all in his memory, even to the revelation. God hath revealed to him, even at midnight alone, what shall be his portion in the next world. And if he dare but remember that night's communication between God and him, he is well learned enough. So, the importance of memory. It can be historical memory, it can be personal memory, but to remember is an act of, you know, literally remembering, putting your members together, making yourself whole. Third method that Dunn uses is to offer human examples. In keeping with this principle of using lifelike situations, Dunn's examples are not idealized figures, but real, recognizable, struggling individuals. Dunn's model for this technique is God's practice in the Bible. God illustrates his precepts, comments upon his own text by examples. First, to raise us to the best height, God makes himself our example. Sicut Pater, be holy as your Father in heaven is holy. Then, because we cannot reach to that, he makes men like ourselves, at least as such as we should be, our example. Sicut Elias. Elias was a man subject to like passions as we are, and he prayed that it might not rain, and it rained not, and that it might, and it did. If we be not able to conform ourselves to the singularity of one particular and transcendent man, he sends us to the whole body of good men, his servants. Sicut Prophetae, take my brethren the prophets for an example of long patience. So, examples. These are not the example of perfection. They are the examples of struggling individuals. But they are types of Christ. They are how we can recognize ourselves. Dunn even makes the point that it's not just the good and just figures of history that provide models for imitation, but even the wicked. He says, it is a true and useful rule that ill men have been types of Christ and ill actions figures of good. Much more may things not ill in themselves, though deflected and detorted to ill, be restored to good again. What this means is that Dunn does not represent idealized holy figures for imitation, but these complex, struggling, divided, believable men and women whose actions must be evaluated with the guidance of the Holy Ghost. Dunn represents his types neither as shadows lacking substance nor as perfect figures having no bearing upon the enigmatic and sinful life people know intimately. Thus, figures we are likely to meet in both Dunn's poetry and his sermons are often animated characters, the same sort of characters that we would meet in the character books. You know, these are very popular in the period. What does a soldier look like? What does a con man look like? You know, we have these portraits, these verbal portraits in these character books. But of course, we're familiar with them from, you know, the characters in the drama of the period. Shakespeare's Globe was filled with them. So what Dunn does often in his poetry and in his sermons as well is animate these figures. Dunn frequently doesn't speak in his own voice, but presents a dramatic monologue where the reader is invited to evaluate the speaker. The speaker might be a cynical lover, a con man, an earnest partner. In his sermons, Dunn frequently assumes the role of a character in a strategic moment to forward the restorative action of the address to the hearers. In one sermon, rather than merely theoretically and theologically stressing the dangers of spiritual despair, Dunn enacts such a character so that those in the congregation might recognize themselves and thereby act on that recognition. Now, this is one of Dunn's characters, one of these portrayals, in the midst of his sermon. See if you can recognize the kind of shape and demeanor of such a despairing person. Does he mean all my sins? He knows what original sin, and I do not. And will he forgive me sin that is root and sin in the branches, original sin and that actual sin too? He knows my secret sins, and I do not. Will he forgive my manifest sins and those sins too? He knows my relapses into sins repented. And will he forgive my faint repentances and my rebellious relapses after them? Will his mercy dive into my heart and forgive my blasphemous words there and bathe the members of this body and forgive my unclean actions there? Will he contract himself into myself and meet me there and forgive my sins against himself and scatter himself upon the world and forgive my sins against my neighbor and imprison himself in me and forgive my sins against myself? I think you can see that by a character speaking and questioning in that particular voice, it persuades the listener in a way that theories or theological treatises or explanations might not. What happens in this particular passage is the listener is able to see the faithless trap he sets for himself by believing in God's might, but not in his mercy. When the desperate speaker multiplies his sins and imagines God sees even more of them, he thereby admits God's omniscience. When he continues to enumerate sins, relapses, faint repentances, rebellion, he also hints at the vastness of God's dominion. The speaker then repeats the question, but this time enlarges the meaning and emotional impact of forgiveness. When he asks, "Will his mercy dive into my heart? And will he bathe the members of this body?" he implies both the heroic quality of God's mercy and his tender and succoring aspect. See, what I'm suggesting is that in that presentation of that character, like a performing character on stage, it does more to convince and move the congregation or the congregants in a way that theological methods might not do. So anyway, these three methods, arresting, reminding, providing recognizable human examples, are characteristics that you see in Dunn's poetry and in his sermons. And of course, they enlist the reader or listener in a process of imitation of gradual restoration from brokenness or detachment to wholeness and involvement. The process, as I say, is most notable in the sermons, but it's also present in some of his poems as well. So these are some of the methods that we could say Dunn uses in order to catch the conscience of a king. And a courtier, and a churchman. Okay, but how specifically could Dunn be seen to be advising powerful? I want to turn to three separate examples. One comes from a set of poems, the satires, and the two are sermons. The other two are sermons preached on very particular occasions, and I want to address those occasions. Okay, so first of all, the satires. Satires in the English Renaissance were a particular form until they were banned in 1599, most likely because the form was seen as potentially socially destructive and destabilizing. In the time, satires were seen as any sort of commentary on personal or social values. Dunn's satires address a number of abuses at court. There are five of them. The first addresses the opportunism and lechery of a young fop. The second concerns corrupt lawyers. The third examines religion. The fourth deals with courtiers and the court. And the final satire examines officers and suitors. In each, the speaker is not really a misanthropist, but he does rail against the vices of the court. And he does so with complete with brutal and quite gross imagery. The third satire is more meditative in nature than the others. It deals with religion and serves as a kind of center to the others in that series. Here the speaker questions his conversation partner, his interlocutor, wondering why young men are so willing to demonstrate false courage by going to war or going on expeditions or dueling over mistresses and yet have no real interest in what is truly important, as he calls it, our fair mistress, religion. So you'll fight for these mistresses, but you won't fight for a mistress, religion. He then points to the dilemma of choosing the right religious mistress among so many choices. One man is able to find the appropriate mistress in Catholic Rome. Another man is able to find his plain Jane mistress at Geneva, Protestant Geneva, with all its paring down of the fineries of Catholicism. Another content to accept what his parents give to him as a mistress, the Church of England. One man is willing to accept any mistress or church, while another assumes that because one is unfaithful, all mistresses must be. So the speaker then urges the conversation partner to take the issue seriously, claiming, though truth and falsehood be near twins, yet truth a little elder is. So now he's sort of pushing the conversation partner to work harder, to think harder. In a passage that itself imitates the hard work of discernment, the speaker continues to urge finding the right mistress truth and not to avoid the perplexity of doubt. I'm just going to put this on the screen because it's poetry, and might be easier to see it. So he says, "Doubt wisely. In strange way to stand inquiring right is not to stray, to sleep or run wrong is. On a huge hill, cragged and steep, truth stands, and he that will reach her about must and about must go. And what the hill's suddenness resists, wins so, yet strive so, that before age, death's twilight, thy soul rest, for none can work in that night. To will implies delay, therefore now do. Hard deeds, the body's pains, hard knowledge too, the mind's endeavors reach, and mysteries are like the sun, dazzling, yet plain to all eyes." So there's this remarkable image of going up that hill of truth. It's hard going. It demands the body's pains, the mind's endeavors. And so you get the sense of the resistance on that path upward. So as you can see, the poem doesn't solve the dilemmas. Which church? Which mistress? Whom to choose? But the poem does end with a reminder that we must finally not look to human laws, but to God's. As he says, kings have not handed blank charters. Kings have not been handed blank charters by God legally to kill those who displease them. Therefore, the speaker warns that thou mayest rightly obey power, her bounds know. To accept a command beyond the scope of an earthly ruler is mere idolatry. So here is precise advice to those near the seat of power. Truth must always be sought, even when the choices seem overwhelming, and the right choice must not be based on any commands contrary to God's law. Okay, so that's one example of advice to the powerful. I now want to move on to another example. This is a very interesting sermon that Dunn preached to the Virginia Company. And, I have a picture. So you have to, again, thinking back to the historical context. So the colonies in North America are being established. There's the colony in New England. There's a colony in Virginia. The encounters with the native peoples are taking place at just this time. And so the question of how far legitimate authority can extend before it becomes corrupt may be applied directly to a sermon that Dunn preached to the directors of the Virginia Company on November 13, 1622, after news had reached London of the massacre inflicted on the English settlers by the native inhabitants of Virginia. Let me just give you a picture of that, too. Of course, this account comes from you know which side. This is also an Aboriginal uprising when it turned out that the so-called traders were not just there to trade, they were there to move in and overstay their welcome. Anyway, this is the massacre, the uprising that took place. In this sermon, Dunn warned company leaders to resist the temptation to exterminate the Aboriginal people and reminded them that their primary goal was to bring the light of Christ to the same natives. His voice thus countered demands for violent retaliation, such as those suggested by company secretary Edward Waterhouse, who advised, "The way of conquering them is much more easy than of civilizing by fair means." Dunn also implicitly rejected claims by his friend Christopher Brooke that the natives were errors of nature, of inhuman birth, and that they were fathered by Satan and the sons of hell. While there can be no question that Dunn contributed to the enterprise which was the English conquest of the New World, it is important to recognize that he attempted to mitigate its worst effects. Within the context of his age and ideology, Dunn did what he could to prevent whole-scale slaughter of the indigenous people. For instance, Dunn warned that if you seek to establish a temporal kingdom there, you are not rectified. According to Dunn, the appropriate colonial attitude to the New World would be to see the native Virginians as images of God and thereby worthy of receiving the gospel. Oh, if you would be as ready to hearken at the return of a ship, how many Indians were converted to Christ Jesus as what trees or drugs or dyes that the ship had brought? Then you were in the right way, and not till then. Perhaps most importantly, Dunn suggests, the best way of bringing Christianity to the Aboriginal people is for the English to serve as models themselves. Preach to them doctrinally and preach to them practically. Enamor them with your justice and, as far as consisteth with your security, your civility, but inflame them with your godliness and your religion. In a movement to motivate moral action, Dunn recalls to the directors of the Virginia Company that the best example they might follow is their own from former times. In other words, the founders of the Virginia plantation would do well to proceed with forbearance rather than violence. For when I, by way of exhortation, all this while have seemed to tell you what should be done by you, I have indeed but told the congregation what hath been done already. Neither do I speak to move a wheel that stood still, but to keep the wheel in due motion, not to persuade you to begin, but to continue a good work, nor propose foreign, but your own examples, to do still as you have done hitherto. If the Virginia Company continues its former policies, to consider its former good works as examples, as opposed to mounting a new offense of extermination, it will be doing God's work. Unfortunately, in the end, the official objectives that Dunn set out in his sermon to the Virginia Company failed. Native conversion was held to be an unrealistic goal. The colonists waged war on the natives. The project of an Indian college was abandoned, and the whole Virginian enterprise lost its evangelical edge. Dunn could be viewed as part of a losing faction. However, when a crisis came, Dunn attempted to intervene to protect the Indian, to protect the indigenous population. Okay, that's my second example. The third one I want to move on to is Dunn's intervention in the Parliament of 1629. When Dunn preached at the Palace of Whitehall on February 20th, 1629, he did so in the midst of the greatest parliamentary crisis of his generation. With Parliament determined to assert the liberties of the subject and to affirm its own ancient liberties, and with King Charles just as determined to claim the superior authority of the royal prerogative, fears ran rampant that the king intended to dispense with parliaments altogether. These fears were confirmed just a few weeks later after a tumultuous session in the Commons when the Speaker, Sir John Finch, torn between his loyalty to members who had elected him and his loyalty to the king who ordered him not to allow further speech in that chamber, was forcibly held in his chair so that Parliament might not be silenced. These famous events caused Sir Henry Wotton to comment, "Never was there such a mourning as that which occasioned the dissolution, since Phaethon did guide his father's chariot." Remember that Phaethon is the son of Phoebus Apollo. Phoebus Apollo's cart is the sun that goes throughout the sky. One day, like all teenagers, the kid wanted the car. So Phaethon asked his father, Phoebus Apollo, for the chariot of the sun, and of course nearly burned the world because it went out of control. A little footnote there. What I'm referring to, of course, is Henry Wotton's comment about it was chaos. It was madness in the House of Commons. As tension mounted towards this dramatic conclusion to the parliamentary session, which initiated the decade of personal rule, this is when Charles ruled without Parliament. For 10 years, he ruled without Parliament didn't consult it at all. Anyway, Dunn spoke in terms that supported the traditional role of Parliament and cautioned the king against arbitrary rule, even though he was a royal chaplain indebted to the king's favor. The basic question at stake was, must a king govern according to the law, or could he simply govern according to his own whim by asserting the royal prerogative? Naturally, Dunn could not address these questions directly without risking his right to speak at all. Instead, he spoke in politically encoded language, which nonetheless would have encouraged and supported those who opposed the king's absolutist tendencies. Dunn's basic method, then, is to suggest that because God is the King of Kings, and any just ruler would imitate the very methods, that the heavenly king did. So, basically, the idea is, this is what God does. This is how God performs his actions. Therefore, any wise ruler would want to imitate the King of Kings. So, whenever Dunn speaks in terms of God as ruler, he's also implying to the king, to the present king, how he might act. So, Obliquely addressing the matter of the king's authority to govern outside the law, Dunn says, "Shall God judge us, condemn us, execute us at the last day, and not by a law, by something that we never saw, never knew, never notified, never published, and judge me by that, and leave out the consideration to that law which he bound me to keep?" And of course, lying behind Dunn's comment is the theological affirmation that God, according to his secret will, would never predestinate any person to damnation, contrary to the actual godly thoughts and actions of that person. Very hot topic in the time. But to Dunn's audience, the implications for the king and his counselors would be clear. The king must rule by law. Concerning King Charles' growing distrust of the House of Commons and his increasing isolation from their concerns, Dunn offers this observation. God loves to hear us tell him, even those things which he knew before, his benefits and our thankfulness, and our sins in our confessions, and our necessities in our petitions. By implication, then, if a king can expect to be honored with thanksgiving and submission in the admission of error, he must also be willing to hear the needs of his people, such as those continually presented in Parliament. Dunn also wished to uphold the godly virtue of accessibility. Effective communication between all social ranks represented in Parliament would relate the whole kingdom to its spiritual and temporal head. Access to the king's person, along with freedom of speech and freedom from imprisonment, was a traditional privilege of Parliament requested by the Speaker each session. Only by speaking frankly to the king might the nobility separate the king from his flatterers, who tended to confirm him in taking unwise actions. Dunn encouraged the nobility to avail themselves of that which was expected of a king during the sitting of Parliament. Let me just get the king up there. This is what Dunn says. "But it is a precept of accessibleness and of affability. Affability, that is, a civility in the city of God, and a courtship of the court of heaven, to receive other men, the images of God, with the same easiness that God receives you. God stands at the door and knocks, and stays our leisure to see if we will open and let him in. God is no inaccessible God, that he may not be come to, nor inexorable, that he will not be moved if he be spoken to, nor dilatory, that he does seasonably." So Dunn also urged the nobility to speak out at this time of crisis. For many parliamentarians, the mark of their humanity, or at least their status as free Englishmen, was their ability to exercise freedom of speech, particularly in the great council of the realm. This parliamentary privilege was closely linked to in their minds with the proper responsibilities of kingship, beyond which lay tyranny. When the king had decided to collect the forced loan or use martial law without consent of Parliament, he had effectively taken away the voice of the people. Sir Dudley Digges observed, "That king that is not tied to the laws is a king of slaves." Dunn addresses these issues in his sermons when he says, "God hath made other creatures sociable besides man, sheep and deer and pigeons will flock and herd and troop and meet together. But when they are met, they are not able to tell one another why they meet. Man only can speak. Silence makes it but a herding. That makes conversation is speech," says Tertullian. "He that uses not a benefit reproaches his benefactor. To declare God's goodness that hath enabled us to speak, we are bound to speak. Speech is the glue, the cement, the soul of conversation, and of religion too." Dunn, as royal chaplain, speaking publicly, knew the dangers of playing down the demands of the gospel and justice and speaking conventional and safe truths instead. When, at the end of his sermon, he summed up the Christian religion, Dunn knew that his auditory would be looking to him to embody what he preached and would have measured his performance against his advice. "The sum of religion," he said, "is to speak aright and to do aright, to profess the truth and not be afraid nor ashamed of that, and to live according to that profession. By addressing the current parliamentary and court crisis, albeit in politically encoded rhetoric required of one who did not wish to lose his voice altogether, Dunn enacted a model necessary to heal the body politic. Moreover, Dunn would have recognized the irony of a defense of free speech contained within a politically encoded discourse required by a repressive society. Despite Dunn's deference towards the office of king, his auditory, familiar with recent political events, could appreciate his tactics. He was using his reputation to affirm the supremacy of law, to encourage broadly based counsel, to warn against the vice of flattery, to celebrate accessibility, to support the value of free speech in a subject, and to remind courtiers of their duty in providing their sovereign with honest advice. So, I want to move on to the possibility of some contemporary relevance for this man from the 17th century. So, if we can see in John Donne somebody who risked his position and his reputation in order to prevent the violence which eventually came in the English Civil Wars, how can we locate similar situations in our own time? In Western democracies, the same kind of threat of censorship does not pertain, though the censorship of being ignored or marginalized as too radical or too depressing often does. I would say that whenever an individual speaks difficult and inconvenient truths to challenge the powerful, he or she acts a little like John Donne did in the 17th century. Fiction writers like Margaret Atwood or Ronald Wright have given a prophetic vision of the future where our technologies have gotten out of control and led to disaster, for instance. Scientists like David Schindler or David Suzuki warn about the misuse of nature. But even our equivalent of the court jester can play his part in advising the powerful. So let me end on a lighthearted note. Let me refer to the American comedian Stephen Colbert, who plays the role of a right-wing patriot. He plays the role because he isn't, of course, but that is the role he plays. Now, I hesitated in bringing up this comparison because I thought, oh, after moving from this great man, we go to trivia. But I once was at a conference when fairly prominent Dunn scholar Ernie Sullivan said that when he tries to introduce Dunn's poetry to university students, he says, think in terms of a stand-up comedian. You know, because a lot of his poetry is making jokes, making witty jokes, and, you know, it's done by hearing it. And so there is that wit continuously. And they're in Dunn's sermons, they're in Dunn's poetry. So I think that the comparison is not entirely far-fetched. Anyway, at a White House correspondents' dinner in 2006, Colbert addressed both Washington journalists and President George W. Bush. Here's some of what he said. Now, I wasn't entirely sure that the technology would be up to working, so I'm just going to read you this rather than letting Stephen Colbert do it. But of course, this means that I have to play Stephen Colbert, so just bear with me. So, first of all, I have a little picture at least I can show you. So there's Colbert, acting as though he's the president's biggest fan. And here is George Bush, and of course, what I mentioned is, notice the discomfort on the president's face, both here and here. And by the way, there's a wonderful tape on YouTube, if you want to look at this, that gives the speech and then just focuses on George Bush's face the entire time. So you can see him squirming and being displeased. Anyway, let me just tell you what Colbert said. And this is just a snippet. It's about 25 minutes long. You should look it up. It's very entertaining. But here's just a little snippet. He says, the greatest thing about this man, he's referring to the president, right? The greatest thing about this man is he's steady. You know where he stands. He believes the same thing Wednesday that he believed on Monday, no matter what happened Tuesday. Events can change. This man's beliefs never will. And as excited as I am to be here with the president, I am appalled to be surrounded by the liberal media that is destroying America, with the exception of Fox News. Fox News gives you both sides of every story, the president's side and the vice president's side. But the rest of you, what are you thinking, reporting on NSA wiretapping or secret prisons in Eastern Europe? Those things are secret for a very important reason. They're super depressing. And if that's goal, well, misery accomplished. Over the last 5 years, you people were so good over tax cuts, WMD intelligence, the effect of global warming. The Americans didn't want to know, and you had the courtesy not to try to find out. Those were good times, as far as we knew. But listen, let's review the rules. Here's how it works. The president makes the decisions. He's the decider. The press secretary announces those decisions, and you people in the press type those decisions down. Make, announce, type. Just put them through a spell check and go home. Get to know your family again. Make love to your wife. Write that novel you got kicking around in your head. You know, the one about the intrepid Washington reporter with the courage to stand up to the administration? You know, fiction? Okay, so in this snippet, you'll notice certain similar concerns that Dunn had. Some of those concerns are tendencies towards absolutism, ignoring factual evidence, the resistance to hearing critique instead of the speech of flatterers, and the encouragement of critics to use reason and speech for the good of the country. Thanks. So, questions, thoughts? I know it's a lot to take in. A little tour through the 17th century and then look at a particular person.
So, Paul, for him to, you know, kind of gravitate to this kind of wisdom, what would you say his kind of transforming moment that would lead him to this? Like, what enabled him to kind of come to this kind of wisdom in his background?
Well, I think he had, you know, initially a hard life. In the 17th century, there's those wonderful icons of, you know, the hammer of God breaking a heart. And you do get the sense of a heart that has been opened by suffering. You know, in that funeral sermon I referred to, it's almost a gruesome image of hanging on the cross with Jesus. Yeah, and so there is that, you know, the sense of the valuing of suffering. It talks about the joy hanging on the cross. It says it's not a joy after, it's joy in the moment. So there is this sense of a profound sense of joy in the midst of tribulation. Well, I don't know. I think that might be part of it. He certainly shows a kind of availability, emotional availability in his service, but I didn't keep that.
Yeah. And when you were speaking about those three ways of persuading, I was thinking...
And there's, you know, many others. Yeah. I just picked a few. Yeah.
But what a great therapist.
Exactly. And you know, the process of the sermon is like the process of going through a therapy session,
right,
because
exactly.
It is how to reestablish wholeness. There is salvation, which means health, you know. And so you start with this kind of recognition of brokenness, and then you move through a process whereby you're conformed to the will of God. Mm-hmm. And it should be a healing experience.
Mm-hmm.
And, but you know, in, I mean, I don't want this to sound you know, like it's a lecture or something. I mean, in one passage, Dennis says, we are not upon a lecture, but a sermon.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, a lecture is getting information, but a sermon is an emotionally transformative experience. And that is, you know, the purpose. I mean, that's, you know, what the humanists talked about, the value of persuasion, you know, mm-hmm. is eventually to move the heart, the affections, and then to move them into action. So it is very much a psychological experience. Yeah.
So do you have any other access to the king other than sermons?
He was a royal chaplain, and so he wasn't the only royal chaplain. There would be many of them. But in his sermons, usually when he preaches at Whitehall, he says, and he often indicates that he, you know, whether the king was present or not. So he was royal chaplain both under James and Charles. Now, other access to the king, I presume, ceremonial events, he would be there. We know that he, you know, talked personally to King James because of that conversation they had about his future. But, you know, we don't have a whole lot of information about what other personal contacts there were. And you know, there's also, you know, when Ben's speaking at court, and speaking at Whitehall, you know, he would be addressing not just the king if he happened to be present, but, you know, most of the court at that time. So their access comes through many ways. It might not be direct access, but indirect access to you.
Although, the one connection I can make with the sermon to the directors of the Virginia Company is the poem with, "Oh, my Virginia, my newfound land,"
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
The metaphor of the ministry of the body. Are there more? Can you expand on that line?
Absolutely. It's in this presentation, I was quite protective of Dunbar. I've written an article on the Virginia Company sermon. Basically, what I do there is I see how Dunn is complicit in the conquest of the New World, and he does use those images. I mean, basically, what we've got in this very sermon, the sermon to the Virginia Company, we have those same images of England having to purge itself. And of course, what that means is shipping over the refuse of England to the colonies. We have the images of the king needing to espouse himself to the virgin land, Virginia, planting the seed. All that stuff is there. So certainly, you know, we see it in "Oh My America, My Newfound Land," but it's certainly in this sermon, you know, all those images of taking possession.
But he's speaking specifically. I mean, the speaker is speaking directly to the mistress, right?
Yes.
And that's the metaphor that's going on.
Yeah.
So I guess, does he feel that he's to blame? Does he feel like he's part of this imperial project in ways that he finds burdensome?
I think his burden is that he sees the horror that is about to happen, and he's trying to stop it. And I mean, Dunn was, you know, part of that investment. He must have felt the burden of that and seen what was about to take place, and tried to stop it. So, you know, I guess you can see it sort of like a tidal wave. There is this movement towards colonialization and conquest, which was brutal, and you know, there's Dunn, you know, doing this little thing to prevent the onslaught. But it's a significant step. So I think I would say that he is worried for what is about to happen, sees there's a much better way. Now, of course, the better way is within the ideology of the times, and he can't be, you know, excused or pulled out from that. But I do think he did what he could. Maybe he did the utmost in those circumstances. Great question. Very complicated. Yeah.
I mean, thinking about the difference between on Wednesday and today, and the difference, the role of the clergy, for example, at that time, the best equivalent I can think of today is the medical profession. They are the priests of our society, it seems to me. Or if you look at the cathedrals of our day, are the skyscrapers that are the headquarters of the banks.
Yeah.
And the agents of moral persuasion to the rich and powerful, we've gone from John Donne to Stephen Colbert.
Well, it's always challenging to try and make that active translation. I mean, if you're going to say, okay, so advising the powerful in our times, who are the powerful? So government, yes, but probably, as you say, more so corporations. So how does a person gain access to that? You know, and so how does one influence in that particular way? So, you know, there's stuff like this, you know, the public realm, you know, how you can break through in a way like that. But I'm sure there are also ways of, you know, getting to directors, or speaking to directors, actually speaking at board meetings and trying to make influence that way. But, you know, your point is an excellent one. You know, how do we translate what was done in one time to another? You know, who are the powerful now? And, you know, to be Dean of St. Paul's would be a tremendously powerful position. You know, you couldn't ignore what the Dean of St. Paul's said. Whereas, I think you can ignore just about what any clergyman has to say.
So what's the role of the church today in this? Does it have a role? Or?
Well, I wonder if we don't have to think outside the church. You know, I wonder if we don't, you know, if we're saying that the place of power has shifted, you know, what does it mean to be an authentic human being? What does it mean to be an honest or truthful human being? Maybe that isn't necessarily to be found in the church or only in the church. And so maybe we have to translate in that way as well.
There's another kind of cunning thing that's occurred that your query raises in my mind. You know, on Parliament Hill, there's a prayer breakfast, which meets regularly on Parliament Hill. But what I discovered is that prayer breakfast is defined in such a way that there is never any political comment. So it's an act of appearing to relate to the religious tradition and an insurance that the voice can never be spoken. It's absolutely opposite of what you're looking at here.
Mm-hmm. That's certainly not what's happening with the religious right in the U.S., for example, and their attempts to influence the political landscape and the kind of policy decisions.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah.
But they do that not through the prayer breaks. They have C-Street. Other ways of doing that.
Yeah.
I have sort of a personal question.
Oh.
Knowing that your father was a United Church minister in Winnipeg and often spoke with important people, you know, either at the civic level or maybe even government, and you had to sort through your dad's sermons in the last years. I'm just curious, like, do you know, like, did he confront power in your actual living in Winnipeg?
I think he, you know, his pulpit would have been the classroom. And, you you know, probably whatever influence he would have exercised would have been through that kind of more diffused method rather than doing it directly. But, you know, I mean, the people that he championed, you know, people like, taught were people like Reinhold Niebuhr and Richard Niebuhr and people that were in the thick of social justice. And so, you know, he would have seen that as a key way of relating religion and power, you know, for good. So the civil rights movement and that sort of thing would have been part and parcel of that. Yeah.
I have an interest in, I guess we could call it the arts of indirection, to try to get an idea across. I mean, in the case of Stephen Colbert, we have a version of today's all licensed fools. So he's able to do that. I do believe there are some initially, maybe even now, who haven't figured out that it's an act. But it's over the top enough that it works. But there's always the potential for being misread and misinterpreted. Mm-hmm. And I think what it is to teach first-year students the Modest Proposal or something like that. Irony is hard to pick up on. And wondering when Dunn, in speaking to power, seemed limited, we would expect, to arts of indirection, was it generally understood what he was doing? Or is this a 20th century scholar who can go back and discover what we think he may have been doing, but nobody picked up on it at the time?
I don't think so. You know, in the Renaissance, people were, you know, for example, people have asked, you know, why was it that Shakespeare was able to pull off what he did? You know, when you think of it, sitting down and watch Hamlet, you know, goes by three, 4 hours, you know. You know, watching this dialogue, this intense intellectual drama, was partly because people were trained by going to church, listening to complex theological arguments, listening to, you know, the Bible being quoted to them, and different parts of the Bible being thrown back and forth. And so, you know, this was, in many ways, an extremely literate culture, you know, and able to take that kind of thing in. And I think not just you know, in the nobility, but, you know, everyone would be at church, everybody would be at a play of Shakespeare's, you know. So, yeah. You know,
what happens in Hamlet is the king figures it out, and he gets up and leaves.
Yeah.
Any sense of what Charles did in response to this particular story?
Yes. I guess the only thing you can say is maybe it could have been a whole lot worse. But, you know, just like what happened in Virginia, we finally got the Civil War, precisely the things that Dunn was warning against. You know, his tendency towards absolutism was carried. Parliament was banished, you know, and the Civil Wars began. So, no, didn't listen very well. But let me just say one other thing that I think is really important, and that is, Dunn took very seriously this notion that within every curse of God there is a blessing. And the first curse is, of course, the curse of labor. And I think Dunn believed that labor was a blessing. And that through labor, one became regenerated. And so, in the process of reading one of Dunn's poems, or listening to one of Dunn's sermons, there is this complex challenge to figure it out. I mean, you're not let off easy. He doesn't do all the work for you. And so there is that sense of, you know, going up the hill of truth, the mind's endeavors, the body's pains, you know, there is the sense of the work and the challenge involved in doing that. I mean, you know, the other poetry of the period is, like comparisons. The lady's lips are like cherries, her breasts are like snow, you know, that sort of thing. And then Dunn says, you know, my love is like a mathematical compass. Pardon? You know, you have to figure it out. And the work of figuring it out is where the blessing comes in. And that's how the image of God is restored. It is through the balancing. You know, that passage I read, doubt wisely. You know, it's not the kind of thing that preachers often say. It says, doubt, and doubt wisely. To stand inquiring right is not to stray. So, you know, he is basically saying you must use your brain, you must use your imagination. I mean, Dan also said in Devotions Upon Emergent Occasions, God is a literal God, but God is also a metaphorical God. And by extension, you might say, an ironic God. I mean, he does quote the Bible to show precisely this kind of thing. And so I think it's always a challenge, you know, to recreate the image of God by that work of weighing and discriminating and working it out. Okay.
Thanks so much, Paul. That was great.